Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is the renowned developmental psychologist and philosopher Alison Gopnik. As a leader in the field of children's learning and development, she's a proponent of the idea that children's minds can help us to get to grips with some of the most fundamental philosophical questions. She was a founder of the study of theory of mind, which paved the way to greater understanding of the way children relate to the minds of others, and also put forward the theory, which suggests that babies and young children learn about the world in a scientific way. She's written several books on the subject, including How Babies Think, The Scientist in the Crib, and The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. And this is the one we'll be focusing on today. Hello, Alison. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hi, happy to be with you.
Okay, well, should we just jump straight in, Alison? The perception regarding how babies and young children view the world and operate in it has changed radically in the last 30 or 40 years. How has this change come about?
Well, if you'd asked psychologists and philosophers and psychiatrists and even pediatricians 30 years ago, they would have said that babies and young children were irrational and egocentric, that they couldn't take the perspective of other people, they couldn't think logically, they couldn't understand causal relationships. The great philosopher John Locke said that babies were blank slates, and the great psychologist William James said they lived in a blooming, buzzing confusion. So basically the picture was that there wasn't very much going on. And in the last 30 years, that picture has been completely turned on its head. So what we've discovered is that even the very youngest babies already both know more and learn more than we ever would have thought was possible in the past. And I think that revolution's come about because we learned how to ask babies and young children what they think in their language instead of our language. So instead of, you know, you give a nine-month-old a five-part questionnaire to fill out, they're not going to sound very smart. So what we did was figure out how to look at where children look, what they do, very simple things that they say, as a way of trying to figure out what was going on in their minds. And when we did that, it turned out that even the youngest children were much smarter than we ever would have thought before.
You say in the book that learning is about the way the world changes our mind, but our minds can also change the world. Could you expand on that?
Well, one of the interesting things about the kind of learning that I've looked at especially, which is causal learning, learning about cause and effect, is that when we go out into the world and we look at it, we can use the information that we get from the world to figure out cause and effect relationships. But one of the interesting things is that when we know about cause and effect relationships, we can actually use that knowledge to actually make the world different. So we can, in particular, we can imagine different ways the world could be. We can do what philosophers call counterfactual reasoning. We can think about ways the world could be different from the way it actually is. And then we can actually go about making that a reality. So we can actually go out and change the world to make it the way that we imagine it or the way we think it might be possible. So we do both our understanding, especially our causal understanding of the world, sort of has both sides to it.
Sure. Okay. How do scientists then solve the problems of causal learning? And in what ways do babies employ similar strategies?
Well, if you think about how scientists figure out how the world works, they do three kinds of things. One thing they do is they analyze patterns of statistics. They do experiments, and they sometimes do thought experiments. They try and just make kind of logical deductions. And over the past 30 years, we've shown that young children and even babies are doing all three of these things. So for statistics, it's sort of remarkable. You would not have thought, I mean, even grown-ups have a hard time analyzing statistics. But there's an increasing body of work that shows that if you show babies and young children statistical patterns, they can actually draw the right conclusions from them. So in our work, for instance, we show children a little box that lights up and plays music when you put some things on it and not others. We call it the Blicket detector. And what we can do is actually show children different statistical patterns. So for instance, in a recent experiment that we did, we looked at 24-month-olds, and we either showed them that a block made the machine go 4 out of 6 times, or that it made it go 4 out of 12 times. Now, the statistics tell you that the 4 out of 6 is a better bet than the 4 out of 12. But of course, you sort of have to do the math to figure out those probabilities. And it turns out that even 24-month-olds will pick the 4 out of 6 block instead of the 4 out of 12 blocks. And that's just one example of many of babies and young children using statistics in a really, really remarkably sophisticated way.
So it appears that babies then are acutely interested in disconfirming evidence, in a sense. Do they actively look to falsify things to make better theories?
Well, there's some beautiful recent experiments. So the second way that we that scientists find out about the world is by doing experiments. And there's some really lovely recent work. There's a paper that just came out a couple of weeks ago in Science that showed that even 11-month-old babies were especially sensitive to the unexpected, to things that they hadn't expected to happen. And not only were they incredibly sensitive to this, but they actually did experiments to try and explain the unexpected results. And the way they did this experiment, again, so you might say, well, how on earth could you tell this with 11-month-olds? What they did was they showed the 11-month-olds different patterns of events, either possible or impossible. So either they showed them, for instance, a ball that seemed to magically pass through a wall, or they just showed them a ball acting the way balls usually do, just going through empty space. Or else they showed them a ball that seemed as if it rolled off the end of a ledge and magically hung there in midair, or else the ball that just rolled down the ledge the way a ball usually would. And they discovered two really fascinating things with these 11-month-olds. First of all, the babies paid much more attention to the unexpected outcome, the ball that seemed to magically pass through a wall, or magically seemed to hover in thin air. Not only that, but then when they gave the babies the balls to play with, they played with the peculiar unexpected ball more, and they played with it in a way that was actually designed to try and test a hypothesis. So if the ball looked like it mysteriously went through the wall, then they banged the ball against the surface of the table. Whereas if it looked like it mysteriously hung in thin air, then they dropped it off the table onto the floor. So it was like they were saying, wait a minute, blocks are supposed to be solid. What's going on? Is this one really not solid? Is it really something that can somehow dissolve? Or else, oh no, these balls are supposed to not hover in the air. Gravity is supposed to make them fall to the ground. Is this one escaped from the forces of gravity? And that's just one, that's a particularly dramatic experiment with particularly young babies, but there's a whole lot of experiments that suggest that in children's everyday play, they're actually experimenting to try to test hypotheses and figure out whether they're true or not.
So that, arguably that most pernicious of biases, confirmation bias, with babies hasn't really got a footing yet. Do they think a lot more provisionally than they do dogmatically?
Well, that seems to be true. So we've done some other experiments with 3- and 4-year-olds where we give them evidence for an unlikely or unusual hypothesis, something that's kind of not obvious. And what we've discovered is we take our wonderful, bright Berkeley undergraduates and 4-year-olds, and we give them exactly the same pattern of evidence. But that pattern of evidence either could be explained by something that's very obvious or something unlikely. The 4-year-olds are much more likely to get to the unlikely hypothesis than the Berkeley undergraduates are.
Okay, and of course babies don't just have theories about things, but they have theories of mind as well.
Well, one of the most important things for babies, one of the most important things for all human beings, is to figure out what's going on in the minds of the other people around them. And in work that we started doing in the 1980s, we discovered that, again, even very young children, even babies, are paying tremendous attention to what's going on in other people's minds. And again, this goes against the conventional wisdom, which was that babies and children were egocentric until well into the school age years, until they were 8 or 9 years old. We showed, and other people have shown, that even very young babies already are paying attention to what's going on in other people's minds and understand other people as mental agents. And so we've done experiments that show that even 15 and 18-month-olds, for instance, are trying to figure out what someone else wants, and they'll actually act to help that other person to get them what they want.
There was a really interesting experiment with the crackers and the broccoli. I thought that was very illustrative of that, really. Could you just expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so we wondered if there was a way that we could ask the babies whether they really were egocentric or not without using language. And what Betty Repicoli, who is my student, and I did, so we gave the babies two bowls of food, one bowl of goldfish crackers, which are American crunchy, delicious, cheesy crackers, and one bowl of raw broccoli. And all the babies liked the crackers more than they liked the broccoli. Then the experimenter would put out her hands and take a little bit of food from each bowl. So either she'd take a little bit of broccoli and act as if she either liked or didn't like the broccoli, in the same way with the crackers. So half the time she'd act as if what she wanted was the same as what the babies wanted. So she'd act as if she really liked the crackers. She'd go, mmm, crackers. And oh, yuck, broccoli. But the other half of the time, for the other half of the babies, she reversed it. So she acted as if what she wanted was the opposite of what they wanted. So she acted as if she really liked the broccoli, broccoli, and yuck, crackers. And then she simply gave the babies the two bowls, put out her hand and said, can you give me some? The question was, what would the babies do? Well, one interesting thing was that both 15 and 18-month-olds tried to figure out what she wanted and give it to her. But the 15-month-olds just assumed that she wanted the crackers. So they didn't seem to understand that she could want something different than they did. And they gave her the crackers. The 18-month-olds, on the other hand, not only figured that if she wanted something, they should help her to get it, but they also figured that if what she really wanted was the broccoli, they should give her the broccoli. And that's exactly what they did. So these very tiny babies, these are only 18 months old, already seem to have understood something quite profound about other people, which is that they might want something different from you. And they're also acting in a profound and, in some sense, a way that suggests the kind of underpinning of altruism and morality. They're doing things to help her to get what she wants.
How do babies' brains differ from adult brains?
Well, it seems that babies' brains are much more flexible. They're much better at changing than adult brains, but they're much less efficient. They're much less better at doing anything in particular. So if you look at a baby's brain, what you see is that there are many more neural connections, many more connections between brain cells. And they grow during the time that the babies are little. So in the early period, babies are making many, many, many new brain connections. And what happens as we get older is that the connections that we use a lot become strengthened and more efficient. And the ones that we don't use get pruned. So the ones that we don't use, we lose. Now, that may sound like a disadvantage for adults, but that pruning means that as adults, we have a kind of lean, mean brain machine. We're very good at doing the things that we do very well and swiftly and effectively, and babies are not very good at doing things well. But on the other hand, it means that we lose that flexibility. So we lose the ability to learn how to do things in a new way, which seems to be characteristic of the baby brain.
And do you think that's related to what we were talking about earlier when we were talking about provisionality and dogmatism? Do you think that lean meanness also means that adults are less open to new possibilities?
Exactly. So the idea is, if you think about this from an evolutionary perspective, one of the great interesting evolutionary puzzles is why it is that we have such a long period of immaturity in childhood. And human babies are immature, demand being taken care of for much longer than the babies of any other species. And why would that be? Well, there seems to be a kind of trade-off. Either you can have a brain that works very, very effectively and very well, but isn't good at changing in the light of new evidence, or you can have a brain that's very good at change, but isn't going to be quite as effective at actually getting things done. And it seems as if the way that evolution solves that is by having this kind of trade-off where we have an early period when we don't know very much yet, but we're open to lots and lots of possibilities. And then the more we get to know, the narrower, in some sense, our focus becomes. And I think that's a very general difference between babies having this kind of open mind versus adults having a more narrowly defined mind. But I also think it's an interesting general point, which is that adults very often are in a state of wanting to plan and act. And one of the things about planning and acting is that it necessitates that you inhibit some impulses and thoughts, that you're in this very narrow range of here's what I want to do and here's how I want to get there, as opposed to babies and young children who are trying to basically get as much information from the world as they possibly can.
You've used the analogy at times that babies are the R&D department of the human species, and yeah, we're production.
Yeah, exactly. So we're trying, not all the time. I mean, even adults in some circumstances, I think, can get the kind of open beginner's mind that children have. But most of the time, what we're doing as adults is we're planning and getting through the day and organizing and making things happen out in the world. And that's not a state that's very conducive to learning new things or getting more information about the world.
Sure, yeah. Okay. What are your thoughts on the philosopher Peter Singer's contention that babies lack personhood consciousness?
Yeah, I think that's ridiculous. I think it reflects the fact that Peter Singer doesn't know anything about babies. But it's not an unusual view. So again, as I said, for most of human history, most philosophers, if they paid attention to babies at all, thought that babies were sort of defective grown-ups, which is basically what Singer is arguing. Because the idea was that you needed to have self-reflective language in order to be able to have thoughts or have concepts or have consciousness. And I think actually the data is exactly the opposite. When we look at even the youngest babies, they're already pulling in so much information from the world and organizing it and making sense of it, that I think there's actually good reason to believe that babies are in some respects more conscious than we are as adults. After all, what we do as adults, part of this agenda that we typically have of being able to do things swiftly and effectively, is that things become unconscious for us. So one of the things that happens when you do something over and over again is it becomes a habit and you don't have a kind of vivid phenomenological experience of it. And for babies, one of the things I said in one of my, in the philosophical baby is, you know, every day is first day you've ever been to Paris. It's skydiving for the first time. It's doing something completely unknown and unimaginable. And I think in general for human beings, that's a state that puts us in a more vivid state of consciousness, not less so.
Yeah. You talk about babies having more of a type of lantern consciousness as opposed to spotlight consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good description. So it may be that they don't have more, you know, you sort of count up the consciousness units, they may not have more. But for grown-ups, there's a metaphor that people have used for a long time. For grown-ups, our consciousness is typically very closely tied to our focused attention. And it's kind of like the spotlight that we apply to the things that we want to find out about. But there's lots of data that for adults, when we pay close attention to one thing, other things get shut down. We actually literally don't see the things that we're not paying attention to. And both the physiological and the psychological evidence is that for babies, in contrast, and I mentioned this before, babies are most interested in, pay most attention, not to the things that they decide to pay attention to or the things that are most important for their goals, but to the things that are going to teach them the most, the things that have the most information.
And if we wanted to emulate babies and cultivate more of a beginner's mind, how would we go about it? You mentioned like travel.
Yeah, I think travel is actually a good, simple idea that we sort of take for granted. But if you think about your consciousness when you're in a strange place, essentially what's happened is you're putting yourself in the position of a baby because you don't have the usual well ingrained ideas about what you should do when you say are in, especially in a place that's really different from where you usually are. And I think what happens is your planning and executive and adult abilities really suffer in those circumstances. But certainly, you know, you have more of a sense of being alive and vivid that you take back from that time than you would otherwise. And I think that some forms of meditation may operate in a similar way. So I think it's interesting that a common thread in meditative traditions is sitting still, not doing things. And a tremendous amount of your cognitive energy in the normal course of events goes into just getting yourself from one place to another. And I think that may be another situation in which you can emulate the state that babies are in. Now, of course, the difference is, you know, someone who's meditating, for example, is consciously putting themselves into that state. And the babies can't consciously put themselves into any state. They just are in that state when things around them are interesting and they're fed and happy and they're not miserable or asleep. But I think adults have the additional ability to actually consciously, as it were, decide not to decide or attend to not attending.
Could we just explore a little bit more that topic of altruism and to what degree babies and young children are moral agents? For example, can they distinguish between rules and harm?
Well, there's quite a lot of evidence that by the time babies are 2.5 years old, they can distinguish between just something that's a social convention and something that's more like what we would think of as a genuine moral rule. So if you ask 2.5 and 3-year-olds, suppose that everybody in the daycare decided that it was okay to hit another kid, would it be okay to hit another kid? The 3-year-old say, no, it wouldn't be. But if everybody in the daycare, the teachers and the parents all decided it was okay to drop your clothes on the floor, then it would be okay to drop your clothes on the floor. It isn't okay now because, you know, the teachers don't think that it's okay. But in principle, it would be okay if everybody decided on it. But it would never be okay to hit somebody else.
That's great. And that's at 2.5, you're saying?
Yeah.
And am I right in saying that you don't see a connection between mirror neurons and empathy? This has been a big thing in the last 10, 15 years. You mentioned a certain degree of skepticism with that in the book.
Yeah, I think most serious people in neuroscience are pretty skeptical about that, at least in a simple form. And there's a number of reasons for being skeptical. So, for example, the place where they've actually found mirror neurons are in animals like macaques that don't actually have very complicated kinds of social interactions or empathy, that don't even necessarily imitate each other very much. So if mirror neurons, we know that there are mirror neurons there, and we even have some ideas about the functions that they might serve. In just coordinating the animal's visual impression of their own body, for example, and their kinesthetic impressions of their own body. But the idea that somehow they're responsible for these high-level things like language or empathy or morality, I just think just doesn't make any sense at all. If you look at the very simplest human abilities, like being able to see an edge, being able to see an object, there are literally hundreds of different kinds of neurons that do different things that are all interacting to make something like that happen. So the idea that a single neuron is going to underpin something as complicated as human empathy and morality just doesn't really make sense. But on the other hand, it's, you know, one of the things I say is it's like a kind of modern myth. It's like the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. We have these kind of brain myths where ideas that are sort of vaguely there in neuroscience become bits of mythology, bits of mythological metaphor that people like to use.
However, you do suggest in the following passage in the book that there might be another way for empathy to motivate altruism. I'll just quote this. It's possible that babies literally don't see a difference between their own pain and the pain of others. Maybe babies want to end all suffering, no matter where it happens to be located. For them, pain is pain and joy is joy. Moral thinkers from Buddha to David Hume to Martin Buber have suggested that erasing the boundaries between yourself and others in this way can underpin morality. Now, we know that children's conception of a continuous separate self develops slowly in the first five years. So how do you go about erasing these boundaries?
So one of the things that we know is that mirror neurons are no mirror neurons, even very, very young babies. Already seem to recognize a kind of special connection between themselves and the other people around them. So even young babies seem to put together the way that they feel and the way that other people feel. And in fact, it isn't until relatively late in development, until children are 3 or 4 years old, that you start to see them really building up the idea of a completely separate individual self, a separate individual self that's continuous across time. Uh-huh. So what you might have thought and what people thought in the past was that children started out being egocentric and solipsistic, and they had to learn to connect to other people. And in fact, the research sort of suggests the opposite. It suggests that we start out connected to other people, and we really have to develop the idea of ourselves as these separate individual beings. So again, what that suggests is that as adults, the connection that we have to other people comes very naturally. And I think it comes in these kind of contexts of intimacy, like the relationship that you have to a baby or to a young child.
Could this more diffuse sense of self or ego identification also be a reason why babies experience less cognitive dissonance or biases? After all, arguably the most difficult opposing cognitions are, you know, that I'm a smart person and then I've done something really stupid, and we try to make justifications to reduce that dissonance. If babies have less of a defined sense of self, is it potentially then less of a problem?
Well, I think, as I said before, I think there's reason to believe that babies and children are more flexible in general. There's also some very interesting research by a psychologist called Carol Dweck that shows that especially in Western societies, by the time children are in school, they start to develop this kind of intuitive idea that, for instance, their intelligence is fixed, that it can't be changed, that it's something very basic and fundamental to themselves. And what Carol has shown is that that idea about yourself, no surprise, actually makes you less able to change and less able to adjust to different circumstances. Just teaching children that your brain can change as a result of new evidence, or that this idea that there's either you're smart or you're not smart, actually changes the way that children perform on cognitive tests, for example.
So she's saying basically that intelligence is a skill.
That's right. And what's even more important is that your conception of what your intelligence or your personality is like is as important as what it actually is like, and maybe even plays more of a role than what it is actually is like.
What are the elements that need to be in place to allow babies and young children to flourish? For example, what part does love play?
Well, part of this evolutionary framework that I'm talking about, this idea that we have this long R&D period, this long period of learning, all that depends on the fact that parents are investing enormous amounts of time and energy into keeping these babies alive and to letting these babies have these opportunities for learning. And one of the things we know from an evolutionary perspective is that human beings have more different people designed to take care of babies than any other species. So we not only have biological mothers, but we have fathers who are pair bonded and who are involved with babies. And we have grandmothers, of whom I am very proudly one. And grandmothers are distinctively human. Other animals don't live past menopause. And there's increasing evidence that grandmothers are playing a large role in keeping those babies alive. And we have what the anthropologist Sarah Hurdy calls alloparents. So we have people who are not even biological kin who are involved in caregiving. And one of the interesting things is that what we seem to have done as human beings is to take a kind of evolutionarily determined system that was probably originally designed for biological mothers and their babies. It has some distinctive brain areas and distinctive chemicals involved, like oxytocin. That kind of completely selfless, devoted love. And for humans, that's extended not just to mothers and babies, but to husbands and wives, to friends, to whole communities, to countries. We can, at least in principle, even extend it to all of our fellow human beings and all sentient creatures on Earth. So it's as if this phenomenon of a remarkable phenomenon of selfless love that we need in order to take care of these helpless babies has become at least potentially part of the way that human beings can feel about everybody.
In another quote from the book, you say, "How is it possible for human beings to change? What does this tell us about children and childhood, especially very young children and very early childhood?" There are three intertwined strands in the answer: learning, counterfactuals, and caregiving, or more poetically, truth, imagination, and love. In science and philosophy, these three aspects of human experience are often treated as if they were quite separate from one another. Epistemology, aesthetics, and ethics all have very different traditions. But for young children, truth, imagination, and love are inextricably intertwined. Does this beg the question that it may be actually unhelpful to pass these things out?
Well, you know, we always try to make sense out of things by dividing them up. But I think one of the morals that comes through with looking at young children is that some of the ways that, say, as adult philosophers, we've divided these things up aren't really capturing what's happening in real human experience. So philosophers have talked a lot about epistemology, about how we find the truth. They haven't talked nearly as much about love, particularly the kind of intimate, compassionate caregiving that you see in relationships between babies and their caregivers. That's been sort of invisible. And I think it's important that those two things depend on one another and feed into one another.
Do you think the religious traditions have done a better job with love and understanding children than philosophy has?
Well, it's interesting because the religious traditions often articulate a kind of ideal of love, which is in fact quite similar to this kind of very wide-ranging caregiving and attachment that we see in human beings. But for reasons that I find sort of curious, partly because there's always been a kind of ascetic tradition associated with religion, the link between those emotions and emotions of caregiving hasn't really been something that people have articulated very much. Or if they have, they've articulated it metaphorically by, you know, saying that the relationship between God and human beings is like the relationship between a father and children, or by saying that what a bodhisattva does is essentially love everybody the way that we love our children. So I think people have often pointed to the fact that this particular characteristic of love, that for which the kind of example from a psychological perspective is parents and children, also has these broader implications, is also something that's kind of central to the human tradition. But I think they've tended to detach it from the actualities of parents and children. One of the things I say is, if you think about the great questions that religions are designed to answer, things like what gives your life meaning and what you care about more than you care about yourself and what of you will continue after you, your physical self, has died. If you ask most people those questions in real life, they'd say, well, my children give my life meaning, and I care about my children more than about myself, and I will go on in my children after I'm gone. And that's not just biological children, but all of the sense we have of caregiving the next generation. And yet those responses have been pretty invisible in religious traditions.
What is your understanding of the middle way, Alison? And in what ways are babies, in a sense, practitioners of it?
Well, I think there's some interesting connections between some of the insights in the Buddhist tradition, for example, and what we see with babies. So, for instance, this idea that there's a kind of trade-off between the kind of narrow thinking that comes when you're planning and desiring and trying to get things done, and the kind of much broader thinking that comes when you're looking at the world in this less goal-oriented way. And I think babies are a very good exemplar of that ideal of not being caught up in the narrow path of the individual self, but both being open and aware to the world around you, and in particular, having these kind of more permeable boundaries with the other people around you. I think there's a good argument to be made that babies are spontaneously in both of those states. One of the things I say is, you know, the conventional wisdom has been this idea about babies as defective grown-ups. I think a better way of thinking about them from an evolutionary perspective is to think about it as being two stages of the same creature, like butterflies and caterpillars, except that I think from the Buddhist tradition as well, we are the caterpillars who are humping along our little narrow paths trying to get the next source of food. And they're actually the butterflies who are flitting around, exploring, seeing all the possibilities in the world around them.
Well, my last question, Alison, if people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Yeah, a simple thing to do is go to my website, which is alisongopnik.com. And I actually write a column for the Wall Street Journal, the American newspaper, every 2 weeks. And you can look at those columns, and I cover a wide range of different ideas. And on my website, you can see both my more popular writing and also the academic research papers that are there. There's a couple of review paper in Science, for example, recently, where I tried to cover a lot of this material. And you can also look at my TED Talk. So I have a TED Talk. So that's 18 minutes trying to summarize a lot of these ideas.
Great. Okay. Well, for the listeners out there, I'll make sure that I put all the links both on the site and also in the YouTube slideshow that I'm making with this. Anyway, Alison, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today and absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much for speaking to me.
Great. Well, thanks. Good to talk to you.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.